Part 4, Chapter 12, in which the Fat Captain Sings. The voice was that of a tenor from the Opera di Milano, who had stopped into the cathedral to test the acoustics. He was standing in the apse, surrounded by a group of admirers, amazed by the richness of the echo. It was as if there were two voices, one at each end of the nave, which, of course, there were, for as soon as Harvey had risen to his feet, he began to imitate the artist. When the singer realized the echo was coming from the captain, he motioned for him to join his group in front of the altar. At first, Enrico was pleased to meet our hero, and he playfully tested his powers of imitation. "See if you can follow this," he said, performing a complicated scale. The captain reproduced it to perfection, and Enrico tried another. Again Harvey's performance was flawless, and some of the spectators suggested it was superior to the original. When Enrico heard this, he became angry, and began to put forth more and more difficult challenges, each of which the captain managed to duplicate. Finally, with his face red with fury, the tenor belted out an aria which soared through the cool air, filling the church as it rose toward the cupola. But, unfortunately, it never reached its destination, for Enrico's voice cracked when the note was halfway there, shrouding the church in a sudden silence. Not comprehending the seriousness of the situation, Harvey produced a perfect imitation, including the cracking voice, and the onlookers all burst into laughter. But it was no joke for Enrico, whose vocal cords had been damaged, and when the others realized what had happened, they apologized for their mirth and rushed him to the hospital. The diagnosis was a dire one. He could not perform for at least a month. "Where will we find a replacement?" said the tenor's manager, throwing up his hands. Just then Harvey, who had accompanied the group to the hospital, scooted by in a wheelchair sequestered from the entrance. "Aspetti!" cried the manager. The captain's first performance was in Venice the following day. Playing opposite the lovely Leda Bartoli in La Traviata, Harvey was a smashing success. The beautiful soprano was so impressed by his performance that she even permitted herself to make a rare public appearance, and she invited him to join her for dinner on the Piazza San Marco. The narrator breaks in here. "Cara Venezia, storied city of legend and illusion, fabled home of the gliding gondola cleaving moonlit canals. Here the dream is revealed. Here is the rhythm of romance. Half in moon, half in shadow, the gay gondolier touches his guitar and sings." They had a delightful meal, despite repeated interruptions from autograph seekers, and there seemed to be a special chemistry between them, though Leda couldn't be sure until Harvey dipped his finger in his wine and spelled her name on the cloth of the table. Footnote. Ovid, in his Ars Amandi, has written, "A fine method of making one's love known to a lady at a banquet is to dip a finger in wine and write her name on the table." As soon as he did, she asked for the check and hailed a gondola to take them to her hotel on the Lido. It was clear and starry as they set out from the plaza, and the lights of the buildings glittered on the water. Curiously, there was a group of swans swimming near the bank, and when Leda and Harvey passed them in their skiff, one of the males took to his wings and rose into the sky. Soaring in a gentle spiral to a height of several hundred feet, he began his descent, and to the horror of the captain and his date, the swan dived straight for Leda. In an instant, his great wings were beating above her, his dark webs caressing her thighs, her nape caught in his bill, and her breast held helpless upon his breast. Harvey, impregnated with the passion of the bird, managed to wrench the fowl from his staggering companion and hurl it into the sea. Shocked and disoriented, the creature flapped about until it found its equilibrium and gathered itself for another attack. This time the captain was waiting, and when the assailant was within reach, he knocked it senseless with the oar of the gondolier. Of course, as the reader has certainly surmised, this bird was no ordinary fowl, but the god of gods come to have his way with the ivory-skinned soprano. Being none too happy with his less-than-royal reception at the hands of our hero, Zeus sped to Olympus and called an emergency meeting of the gods. "Damn this tampering captain," said Zeus when the council was convened. "He's always screwing my nymphs and deflowering my virgins." "Serves you right," said Aphrodite. "I gave him the perfect woman, but Athena made him leave her at Aulis, so don't come crying to me." "That's exactly what I'm going to do," roared Zeus. "Well," said Aphrodite, looking unrelenting, but knowing she would have to give in. Zeus told her to call for her son, and in a moment he appeared. "What can you do," said Zeus, "to control this sex-craved captain?" "Let me see," said the boy, stepping forward and laying a cloth on the ground. He unfurled it slowly, revealing a collection of arrows of all shapes and sizes, totaling more than 14 in all. "This one," he said, "makes the victim fall in love with the first person they see. This one makes humans fall in love with animals. This one makes animals fall in love with humans. This one makes animals fall in love with animals, or gods in the form of animals, who are in love with other gods in the form of animals. This one, which is very popular, makes men fall in love with women who hate them, and makes women fall in love with men who hate them. This one makes a man fall in love with every woman he sees. And this one, perhaps the most popular of all, makes a person fall in love with the idea of love, and not a real person at all." "What about this one?" said Zeus, pointing to a shaft that had been set to one side. "That," said Cupid, "is the last of its kind. It makes a man want to spend the rest of his life with just one woman, though it does not guarantee he will find her." "But while he's looking," said Zeus, "he will not be whoring around with others?" "No," said Cupid. "He will wait out his life in solitude, and if he finds her, he will be forever faithful." Hera said something to her maid-servant, and the young girl snatched the arrow and replaced it with another. [Footnote: The exchanged arrow would make Harvey fall in love with every woman he saw, but would make them unreceptive to him. "This is the one," said Zeus, thinking he had the magical shaft, but taking the one that brought unrequited love. "Aim well, and be certain it strikes the captain in such a way that it pierces his breast, passes his aorta, and lodges securely in his loins." Making sure he kept the chosen arrow apart from the rest, Cupid took his charge and set out to do as he had been told. As soon as he left, Zeus appeased Aphrodite with a beacon of ambrosia. While all this was going on, Enrico, who was bitter about the captain's opening night success, slipped a note into one of the lion's mouths at the ducal palace, and when Harvey and Leda reached the Lido, a group of authorities were waiting for them. [Footnote: Mark Twain, in his novel Innocents Abroad, Chapter 2, writes, "These," the lions, "were the throats down which went the anonymous accusation, thrust in secretly at dead of night by an enemy, that doomed many an innocent man to walk the bridge of sighs and descend into the dungeon which none entered and hoped to see the sun again." This was in the old days, when the patricians alone governed Venice. The common herd had no vote and no voice. The fate of the accused was decided by the infamous Council of Three, who met, masked and robed from head to foot, and did not even know each other, unless by voice. Back to the text. "Arrested?" said Harvey. "What am I accused of?" "Of prying into things under the earth and above in the heavens, of making the weaker argument strong, and of showing people up as being no one when they think they are someone." Harvey was taken to the palace, marched across a small bridge, and thrown into a dungeon. He was left in a cell that was below the level of the water, and lit by the light of a smoking torch. Before the door was closed, Harvey had taken on the personality of the place and all who had been there before him, and in less than 14 minutes he suffered all they had suffered. He was wretched, without light, air, or books, naked and unshaven, and covered with vermin. With no one to speak to, his tongue lost its office, and the days and nights were merged into a single eventless eternity. Far from any cheerful sound, buried in the silence of the tomb, he began to lose his memory, knowing no more who he was or how he came there. He devoured the bread and water that were thrust daily into his cell, and eventually he stopped troubling his spirit with vain hopes and longings to be free. Soon he even ceased to scratch prayers on the walls, for there was no one, not even himself, who could see them. Resigning himself to apathy, then childishness, then lunacy, he prayed to Athena for help. The next morning, the news of Harvey's success at the opera spread across the nation. Mahogany and Idothea, who had been looking for him in Florence, were ecstatic to discover his whereabouts and set off immediately for Venice. But when they arrived, the captain was not to be found. "Perhaps he was taken by the Council of Three," said Idothea. "The Council of Three?" said Mahogany. "Yes," said Idothea. "Their steps and maneuverings are secret, and to find out the hopes and terrors of each individual, there are stone lions into which persons deposit information." "Where do they keep their prisoners?" said Mahogany. "In the prison at the end of the Bridge of Sighs." "Let's go," said Mahogany. Mahogany and Idothea bought tickets for admission to the bridge and the prison, and soon they encountered Harvey's cell. The guard stopped them when they went to enter. "No tourists allowed," he said. "We have come for the man incarcerated here," said Mahogany. "Impossible," said the guard, "for he is charged with entering without buying a ticket, and he has been sentenced to life in prison." Mahogany peeked into the dungeon, and was horrified to see the captain in his pitiful state. "Harvey," he said, "is that you, Harvey?" But Harvey did not answer, for the flight attendant was passing with the duty-free cart, and the captain wanted to buy a bottle of Chivas. When he returned to his reading, Mahogany was still waiting for a reply. "You have the wrong man," cried Mahogany, turning to the guard. "I am Captain Harvey." "No," cried Idothea, "I am Captain Harvey." "No," said Harvey, emerging from the cell, "I am Captain Harvey." "What?" said the guard, feeling he had been thrown into a hall of mirrors. Just then a group of tourists, thinking Harvey's enclosure was part of the exhibit, flooded into his cell. In the sudden confusion, the captain and the others slipped past the guard, fled to the station, and boarded the first train they found. When they had settled in, Cupid swooped down and shot the captain with his dart, and as soon as he did, our hero was thrust into the darkness of consuming desire. "Oh, love," shouted Harvey, "where scorn is bought with groans, coy looks with sighs, and one moment's mirth with 20 watchful, weary nights." When the train pulled into Verona, Harvey cried out again, "This is where I will find her! This is where I will find my desire!" Thought Harvey on the airplane. Back to Verona. He remembered his first time there, plagiarizing verses for the doubting Julia Hathaway. "Will there be another woman, anonymous in the crowd, who will emerge to steal my heart? What new face, at present unknown and unseen, will light in my eyes and become the obsession of my soul? And so my destiny will be determined by a random time and place."